It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. In the New York Times, entitled "The White House and the Strongman: How the Obama Administration Watched the Demise of Arab Democracy and Paved the Way for Trump's Embrace of Dictators." And it opens by saying that Trump boasts that he's reversed American policies across the Middle East, where his predecessor hoped to win the hearts and minds. That Trump champions the axiom that brute force is the only response to extremism, whether in Iran, Syria, Yemen, or the Palestinian territories. He has embraced the hawks of the region in Israel and the Persian Gulf as his chief guides and allies. But in many ways, the hardline approach began, the analysis is that in many ways, the hardline approach began to take hold under President Obama, when those same regional allies backed the 2013 military ouster of Egypt's first elected president, Mohamed Morsi, of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a very interesting parallel, and it's important, I think, to understand in this analysis that things don't happen in a vacuum. And we in the United States have a tendency to get caught up in the personalities of policy, particularly when it comes to foreign policy. And we fail to appreciate and recognize that things don't happen in a vacuum. And so we look at what's going on, say, for example, right now in Yemen, and we want to attribute the current American involvement in the backing of the Saudi government in Yemen with Donald Trump. But we fail to understand that what's happening in Yemen is a result of Obama administration policy, and that one of the reasons why the United States agreed to back the Saudi play in Yemen was because President Obama wanted the Saudi government to buy into the Israeli agreement. I'm sorry, the Iranian nuclear agreement. And so in order to get the Saudis on board, the Obama administration agreed to stand idly by and allow the Saudis to invade Yemen, and not only to give them logistical support, but also to give them arms as well as refueling, mid-air refueling for military strikes and those kinds of things. So this is an interesting piece to read and understand that Barack Obama was a functionary of the United States government. Donald Trump is a functionary of the United States government, and that these policies and these issues go much, much deeper than the individuals and the personalities that are sitting in the White House at a particular time. With that being said, yesterday we spoke with attorney Carlos Castaneda, an immigration attorney with Garcia and Garcia Law in Austin, Texas. And during that conversation, we talked about a migrant mother named Brenda who called his firm from the Port Isabel Detention Center to let them know that she expected to be reunited with her daughter yesterday. When we spoke with attorney Castaneda, that had not happened, and we now have an update. So with that, we're going to go to attorney Carlos Castaneda from Garcia and Garcia. Carlos, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you again.
And it's great to have you because you've got an update. Tell us the update.
I do indeed. I have good news. After a month and a half of being separated, Brenda and her 13-year-old daughter are now together. And more than that, they are now both released from detention and are being staying with certain family members outside detention. And so even though it has been a long process for Brenda as well as her daughter, not only they are reunited, they are able to be reunited outside the confines of a detention facility.
So when you say that they have been released from detention, does that mean that their legal issues are behind them, or
no,
that they are with personal, with family members, and now the fight begins?
Now the fight begins. To a great extent, the fight was beginning beforehand, but
sure,
things get more interesting. But luckily, the psychological pressure on an individual is a lot less. And I can attest to that because, as I mentioned briefly yesterday, the impact on an individual when they are detained for an extended period of time is all the greater, and the desperation caused on a person is what really makes many of them eventually give up or feel that they should give up.
So was Brenda able to describe to you, or was her daughter, and was her daughter able to describe to you the conditions under which she was detained?
I was not able to speak with the daughter herself. Knowing how the regular practice from previous clients that I've had is, the children are usually treated in a fairly decent manner. However, it's not the same being with strangers surrounded by many other children your age and being with a loved one, especially when you're not allowed to leave the premises, so to say. Overall, though, Brenda, any adult, would have a tougher time because it's not going to come as a surprise to you or any of your audience members that adults are treated in a much less deferential manner than our children, even though we are still talking about the civil immigration court system, not a federal penitentiary.
So you with your experience, we've heard a lot about the deadline that the courts had put on the administration and the fact that the administration was not meeting the deadline in terms of reuniting all of the children with their families. Can you give me, in your opinion, the practical reality, understanding that the administration had no plan when they started kidnapping these kids in the first place, but looking at where we are now, what would be your assessment on the administration's meeting the requirements?
Slow, forced, dragging their feet, but ultimately, I have to at least say that I am thankful that we've gotten this far, because ultimately, for a lot of people, even though the U.S. government has dragged its feet on this, even though it's created the problem in the first place, the fact that we are at this stage of just a few weeks, I say just a few weeks after we had this court order, is something very positive for individuals. And Brenda's case is one of those instances in which I can point to a specific human being, a specific family unit, and say, thank God we have something to show for this.
Okay. Well, attorney Carlos Castaneda, immigration attorney with Garcia and Garcia Law in Austin, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for your time and coming back on board and giving us this update. And we can say this is a good story.
Indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I am your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. On the other side, there's much more. Stay tuned. We are back here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And according to my next guest, increasing evidence emerges that confirms what ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern suggests was a classic off-the-shelf intelligence operation initiated during the last year of Obama's presidency against the Trump campaign by employees of and others associated with the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. Yet the public is being counseled to ignore possible proof of state misconduct. To get more insight into this and to some other issues, we turn to my guest. I'm proud to say a voice that is becoming a regular on this program. He's a human rights defender whose experience spans four decades of domestic and international education and activism, and was the Green Party's nominee for Vice President of the United States in 2016. He is Dr. Ajamu Baraka. Welcome back to the Critical Hour. And as always, sir, thank you for carving out time for this program.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's always an opportunity and an honor to get a chance to talk with you.
The piece that I referred to in my opening is you titled High Crimes and Misdemeanors, Not by Trump, but by Obama and Democrats. You know, when people ask me, they say, hey, Wilmer, don't you believe that Russia hacked into the DNC and into the election? And I tell them, you know, I don't know. But what I do know is the folks who are making the claims have provided no evidence of such. Only they cite a report that even President Obama said is inconclusive. And the folks such as Ray McGovern and Bill Binney, who are providing the counter-narrative, have proffered a very sensible explanation that is supported by evidence. And so I tend to give the nod to Ray and Bill. What's your basic premise in High Crimes and Misdemeanors, Not by Trump, but by Obama and Democrats?
Well, you know, my main focus is not even the conversation around whether or not there was hacking by the Russians or anybody else, or to what degree there was some type of manipulation of the electoral process, which is really a sort of a silly charge. What I'm seeing and what is of interest to me and actually quite troubling is this, what appears to be an attempt by high officials in the Obama administration, of the director of the of national intelligence, the director of the FBI and the CIA, and elements of the National Security Agency, to embark on a mission to basically, on their part, to attempt to manipulate the electoral process. I mean, the evidence that suggests that at least a critical question should be raised, you know, is I think is somewhat overwhelming. It's more than a coincidence that you find that the FBI decides that it's going to place an informant in a campaign of a political opponent, and that it uses the information that was generated by that campaign to secure a warrant to be able to further investigate the campaign. And that, you know, you have communications between the various high officials, Peter Strzok, Andrew McCabe, that suggest that they were not just concerned about alleged Russian interference, but they were concerned about the possibility of Trump winning and having, as Peter Strzok characterized it, an insurance policy if that in fact happened. So, you know, to me, this attempt to try to manipulate the electoral process during the campaign and then to shift to attempting to undermine the presidency of Donald Trump, that to me is the part that's the most troubling, because as I said in my piece, what does that imply? If, for example, some progressive or even a radical was able to win that top office, if we allow for the state to obviously involve itself in manipulating the democratic, so-called democratic process, undermining the administration of of a campaign that won, no matter how short-sighted and how flawed this process is, but to allow them to, in essence, these unelected officials, to undermine the ability of that administration to govern, I mean, what would that say if one of us was to win? I mean, it is a troubling assault on democracy, and I'm really quite surprised that more people aren't as troubled by this as I am.
Well, you and I have never met personally. I have followed your career over the years. You and I know and actually have been taught by some of the same people, Brother Mac Jones, for example. So I have found you to be a brilliant guy, a thoughtful guy, a very well-read and experienced individual. And so when you say things like what you just said, it makes me think we don't even have to put this in the context of conspiracy theory. What we know from the COINTELPRO program, what we know from how the United States government dealt with Marcus Mosiah Garvey and the UNIA, we know from how the government dealt with Brother Malcolm. We know how the government dealt with Dr. King. We know how the government dealt with the SCLC and SNCC. So your question about what would happen to one of us if we were to make it into the office of the presidency, I don't think that's a rhetorical question. I think that we have historical basis and documents upon which to ask it and to know what the answer to that question would be.
Exactly.
Is that a fair assessment of your premise?
It really is. And what is interesting is that not only do we know the answer to that question, that they would basically move on us aggressively, it's quite obvious that that would happen because look at what they are doing to a member of their own class, Donald Trump.
Now you use the word class, and I find that an interesting reference because there are many who would say that Donald Trump is a fraud when it comes to being a member of that class, that his billions aren't billions, and that he doesn't really, in fact, they would also say that this is part of his frustration, is that he is truly begging to be accepted in that class, but his frustration is they don't want him, just like Bill Clinton. They looked at Bill Clinton as poor white trash, and in terms of those who are really at the truly in the 1%.
Well, you know, that's an interesting perspective, but I think there's a real fundamental difference between a Donald Trump and a Bill Clinton. Of course, they did have the very similar kinds of class dynamics came into play. They did see Bill Clinton as basically a wannabe and a
interloper.
Exactly. But Donald Trump, I mean, he is part of the he's part of that 1%. And it doesn't matter if he has millions or billions, but he is connected to that. Now, there has been some social frustration in the past because, you know, there's always been the establishment rich have always looked down on the nouveau rich.
There we go.
And especially, you know, folks like Donald Trump, who are relatively somewhat crude and all of that.
I.e., he was not allowed to get into the NFL ownership class.
Well, and he was at first denied membership in the Palm Springs Country Club.
There we go. So that's what I'm basically pointing to. Go ahead.
Right. So there has been those kinds of frustrations. But the fact of the matter is that he is in those circles. He knows those players. And he represents particular kinds of economic forces. Those forces that are more concerned with the national economy, more concerned with small and medium-sized business, who see the elite, the transnational elites as, in fact, elite, with agendas that are contrary to their agenda. And so the base of his political support wasn't just the white working class, but those elements in the middle class and the small bourgeoisie, if you will. And that was the basis of his support and the foundation for his political program. That's why they brought in Ted Bannon, you know, because this was, you know, their orientation. Economic nationalism was the program. And those were the class forces that supported him then and support him today. So, you know, is an intra-class struggle, see it. One of the reasons why the big bourgeoisie was so concerned about Donald Trump was because of the noises he was making during the campaign. He was critiquing and threatening to dismantle the neoliberal architecture that had been carefully constructed over the last 40 years. You know, when he rejected the Trans-Pacific Partnership and talked about renegotiating NAFTA, when he raised questions about NATO and talked about withdrawing forces from Afghanistan and criticized the reckless militarism of George Bush, there was real concern because he was talking about their money, especially those elements that are part of the military industrial complex. And so when he wanted to de-escalate with Russia, primarily because he wanted to complete the pivot that Obama started, the pivot toward Asia, because his real target is really the Chinese, that was seen as a threat to some very powerful elements of the bourgeoisie. And so their objective was basically they were not going to allow this person to effectively govern. And so the undermining of the campaign that started during the campaign continued once he took office. And that's what we are today. And that's why we can't get ourselves all wrapped up into this partisan intra-class struggle. We've got to be sober in our views and in our analysis and understand what is really in play and how does that impact us, working people, you know, low-income people, oppressed people, as opposed to allowing ourselves to be caught up in a fight, a struggle that doesn't really have a whole lot to do with us.
You write in your piece, powerful elements of the ruling class operating with and through the Democratic Party in an attempt to secure maximum electoral success decided that Trump's alleged collusion with Russia shall be the primary narrative to be utilized by Democrats, small d. From the increasing phony opposition represented by the Sanders wing of the party to the neoliberal buck-dancing members of the Congressional Black Caucus, all are expected to fall in line and do thy ruling class's bidding. There, end quote. There's a lot there to unpack. So unpack as much of that as you can.
Well, basically, we saw the realignment that took place among the ruling class when it became clear that Trump won. You had defections from those elements that have primarily supported the Republicans. They defected over to the Democrat Party. Not so much the Democrat Party, but they began to form a coalition, if you will, in order to first to try to deny Trump, but then once it became clear that he had won, to then put into place this attempt to undermine his ability to threaten their interests. And so the campaign rhetoric under Clinton that talked about the Russians and tried to loop Donald Trump in with the Russians, it was just really sort of silly. But that morphed into a more serious campaign once he became president. And when they pulled together their phony documents and their intelligence assessment and presented that to him 3 weeks before he was scheduled to take office, that famous meeting there in the White House where they presented their evidence on alleged Russian intervention. And then everybody left the room but James Comey. And that's when James Comey sprung the other part of the dossier with all the all the dirt, you know, they had on him in terms of his alleged behavior in Russia, all the salacious information about him and certain women and all of this. It was a classic sort of J. Edgar Hoover move to basically let him know they had the goods on him, and that basically, in essence, he was expected to do their bidding. So this is part of what was put in place. Now, he wouldn't go along with this, and he struggled and fought back. They never dreamed he was going to attempt to use modern technology, primarily Twitter, to basically communicate directly with his base. And he was going to stay into a somewhat campaign mode in order to keep that base engaged and to demonstrate his support with the Republican establishment that was also geared to undermine his presidency.
He was going to force their hand and force them to come to the public, basically saying, if you think you got it, bring it.
Exactly. It was classic. I mean, because they had him, and you know, any other person, they would have domesticated him, and made it even at some point forced him from office. But he has engaged in a relatively interesting kind of struggle.
Well, let me just jump in there real quick and say they would have first, as I think they tried to do, force him to toe the party line, and then upon failing to get him to toe the party line, then you start looking at the moves to remove him from office. And he, from the way that you're describing it, he didn't kowtow. He didn't acquiesce. He said, oh, really? Bring it. And so he's now used, to your point, social media as his play. And they're left kind of scratching their heads on what's their next move going to be. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, but they weren't really scratching their heads because they understood they were very clear about what they were going to do.
That they
engage in this prolonged investigation. They were going to not only target Trump, but also target his family, primarily target his son
Don Jr.
Because they knew that basically Trump would struggle to the very end. The way you undermine and break someone like Trump is that you get the goods on their family. And I always said from the very beginning that the real target of that investigation was Don Jr. Because that was the only way they're going to force Trump into a negotiation in which he would probably decide to resign in exchange for them dropping whatever they had on Don Jr.
Well, let me ask you, because our time is limited. Let me ask you to go right to a point in this paragraph that I read where you talk about the primary narrative will be utilized by Democrats from the increasing phony opposition represented by the Sanders wing to the neoliberal members of the Black Caucus. Explain why you see the Democrats basically playing in this game.
They believe that Russiagate was going to be an instrument that they can use and not only undermine the Trump presidency, but also to bring them to power in the midterm.
And also, are they playing to the same donor class that the Republicans are playing to?
They are the class of individuals who are masterminding this thing. The combination of those folks who traditionally had backed the Republicans, but also the traditional Wall Street and military industrial complex donors also. Is a sort of a cross-party or bipartisan, if you will, effort working with the intelligence agencies.
It's an intra-party.
Mind this man.
I'm sorry, inter. It's an inter-party base.
It's a intra-class base utilizing elements from both parties.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, So that's the line. The line is Russian and Russiangate, a collusion.
Mm-hmm.
We can't trust Trump. What was he talking about with Putin by himself? All to undermine confidence in this person's ability to govern and to position themselves better for electoral advances in the 2018 midterm elections.
Now I think the question of what was he talking with President Putin about by himself, I think that is an honest question based upon the self-interest that Donald Trump represents and engages in, and on an emoluments clause question. I don't think that's a, when I say that it's not a bad question to ask, I'm not inferring that there were nefarious things going on, but I do believe that is a honest question to ask based upon the fact that Donald Trump focuses on his personal interest before anything else.
Well, let me tell you something. I believe there were some nefarious things going on.
Okay.
It wasn't between Donald Trump, the personality and the person, and Putin. He was connected to U.S. policies, primarily policies related to Iran and related to Israel, and how the Russians and the U.S. were going to manage Syria. So, yeah, I want to know also. But the point is this. These kinds of one-on-one negotiations between the head of the U.S. And the Russian president and the Chinese prime minister, these things happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is part of the narrative now that Trump can't be trusted. He has his own agenda, blah, blah, blah. That's all part of supporting that narrative. So, yeah, I want to know also. Those questions are legitimate. But, you know, again, they're being manipulated to support that.
Okay, I see your point.
It's all about Trump. Yeah.
And to quickly, because this is you wrote a very deep piece. And let me say to the audience again, the piece is entitled High Crimes and Misdemeanors, Not by Trump, but Obama and Democrats. You write that there are three interconnected reasons why progressives should be concerned. And if you could quickly go through without getting into all of the elements of each piece, but so my audience can understand, have a general understanding of why progressives should be concerned. You say there are three interconnected reasons, and those reasons are?
You know, just like this conversation, you can't help sometimes getting into the weeds of those points. But basically, as we kind of touched on, that if we allow for this kind of behavior on the part of unelected elements of the state to undermine the presidency, then it doesn't bode well for us using the state to advance a progressive agenda and progressive candidates. I'd say that basically, you know, if we allow for the state to push an agenda that allows for it to strengthen itself because of the alleged influences of foreign elements, that is something that's detrimental to us and for democracy here in this country. So, you know, we in the third point, I can't remember.
The third, you said, consequently, the criticism of Trump's foreign policies, including approaches on North Korea and Russia by Democrats, is coming from positions to the right of Trump.
Yes, exactly. And that basically, if we allow that, we are normalizing these far right positions and allowing for us to paint ourselves into the same kind of ideological corner that we saw the left do in Europe. But basically, we end up propping up the very, very same forces we say we are opposed to, because we give legitimacy to these extremist, aggressive, militaristic policies because we are concerned about the U.S. National interests. So all of these are backward, and I say that to allow yourself to be pulled into this struggle in that way is basically to be supporting objectively reactionary positions.
You know, your position, I had a conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn a couple of days ago, and I'll make this point, and then I want to thank you for your time. Gerald said, you know, You have a faction that looks at the United States and their position with other countries in North America, such as Canada and Mexico. And people are saying, we've got to, as people of color, we've got to pick that team. And then you have folks that are looking at the dynamics between the United States and China. And there are those who are saying, we've got to pick that team. And then you have those that are looking at the relationship between the United States and Russia and trying to pick sides between the United States and Russia. And Gerald is saying, we as people of color, we don't have to pick a team. We don't really have a dog in that fight. We have to understand the dynamics that are being played with each of those relationships and figure out what's the best relationship for us. We don't have to pick a team.
He's absolutely right. And that's been my message from the very beginning, that we cannot allow ourselves to be pulled into this struggle. The only thing we have to be concerned about is making sure that we don't allow for our young people to be used as cannon fodder if these folks mess around and get us into yet another military conflict. But no, we don't pick a side. We pick our side.
Interests.
Always remaining clear about who we are and what our objective interests are.
No permanent friends, no permanent enemies, but we do have permanent interests.
There you go.
Dr. Ajamu Baraka, as always, man, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work. And thank you for coming back to the Critical Hour.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right. You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is much more on the other side. Stay tuned. It's Friday, and we're back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik, and I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and with it being Friday, that means that it is time for my panel, and unfortunately, one of my panelists had a last-minute conflict, so we're down to just a panel of two, myself and author and political analyst and host of the weekly Hutchinson Report on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and the Pacifica Network, also the author of Why Black Lives Do Matter, Earl Ofari Hutchinson. Welcome back, Earl, and thanks for coming on the Critical Hour.
Well, you know, it's always a pleasure, Dr. Leon, always.
I greatly appreciate it, as I know you know I do. I want to touch on something that is, I think, to many people, somewhat esoteric, but I think it is incredibly important for people to focus on, and that is the emoluments issue surrounding the president. I talked about a couple of days ago that basically, very simply put, the emoluments clause is, I think it's Article 1, Section 9 in the Constitution that in summary says, as president, you get a salary, and you are not allowed to make any additional monies from foreign or domestic sources as a result of your being in office, which is why when wealthy American presidents or individuals have come into the presidency, they have put their finances into, I was going to say escrow, but that's not the right word. they put their finances into accounts managed by, I'm drawing a blank on the term. They put their holdings into accounts managed by other individuals so that the decisions that they make in office will be somewhat transparent and separate. So with that being said, the District Attorney General's office has released a statement after a favorable ruling in the court that says, the court held that the emoluments case against the president can go forward. And the District Attorney General's office has said, in allowing the suit to move forward, ruling holds that the president is subject to both the foreign and domestic emoluments clause of the Constitution and that the term emolument in both clauses extends to any profit, gain, or advantage of more than de minimis value received by President Trump directly or indirectly from foreign, federal, or domestic governments. And your thought on now the case is proceeding, people are questioning whether or not the Trump Hotel and foreign dignitaries staying at the Trump Hotel, foreign dignitaries engaged in activities at Trump golf courses and other Trump-managed facilities will be considered violation of the emoluments clause.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think the term that you were looking for was blind trust.
Thank you. Thank you, Earl. I knew you'd channel that. That is the term. They were put in blind trusts. Thank you very much.
Yeah, presidents typically do that. Obama did it. You know, Bush did it. Then Clinton did it. They all do it. At least they have done that. Now, Trump, here's the interesting thing. Trump purported to put all of his business assets / dealings in a blind trust. The blind trust could be administered by, are you ready for this, Donald Trump Jr. and two others that are closely connected with Trump International. In other words, his cronies and his son. I believe, I have to check this, I believe one of those that would administer the blind trust would be, I think, the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
One of the daughters, I'm not sure. Okay, it was a family affair. Now, when they looked at that very closely in line with the emoluments that we're talking about, they found something, Wilmer. They found, wait a minute. At the end of the day, Trump is going to come to his son and say, I need X amount of dollars. I need some money to do this and I need to do that. His son is going to say no. Those that are administering the blind, supposedly blind trust are going to say no. Not very likely. In other words, he's still controlling it. He hasn't relinquished anything. This was a ploy, and that's been well exposed.
And he has said that himself. He has said, I'm too rich. It's too complex. You've never had a president with the wealth that I have. I think the Roosevelts would probably count for having more money than Donald Trump, but that's another conversation.
I think the Kennedys might have.
And the Kennedys would be another one. But Donald Trump has said, you've never had a president that has the complex business dealings that I have. And when we really peel the onion back, His business dealings are not that complex. They're primarily marketing and name owning rights. They're not nearly as complex as he wants to make them out to be. But anyway,
no.
So he is saying it's too complex for me to do. I'm not going to do it. I mean, my point in all of that is he has admitted himself that he's not going to divest himself or put his holdings in a blind trust to be managed by who knows who.
Well, we do know who, him. The fact of the matter is, you mentioned the golf courses, you mentioned Trump International, the resorts, the hotels. From day one, he made it clear, I'm not going to stop doing business. I don't care what the clause says. I don't care mm-hmm. what the Constitution says. He hasn't even tried to hide it. He has been shamelessly doing actually two things. Doing business at the hotels, the golf courses,
mm-hmm.
not only in this country, but globally. He'll have dignitaries there. He'll have elected officials there, government officials, business leaders there, and they're doing business all the time, profiteering.
And when he goes to Mar-a-Lago or when he goes to the New Jersey course, the golf course sends the Secret Service a bill, and the Secret Service pays the golf course for the time that Trump is there.
Well, that brings me to my second point. Remember, I said there was two things about that.
Okay.
It's a good segue to the second.
I'm trying to help my guest as best I can.
Yeah, well, yeah. But we're going to amplify that a little bit more. When you say the Secret Service, they send them the bill. It's not just that, Wilmer. You know, law enforcement. You know, it's not just the Secret Service. You've got the Highway Patrol. You've got local police. You've got a whole apparatus in these cities that he, and not only him, by the way, his son, son-in-law, other members of the family, they're also doing business, too. It's not just him. They're all making deals at government expense because every step of the way, we pay for it. This is probably, Wilmer, I don't know where in U.S. history that you could find anything where you've had a sitting president that has nakedly and shamelessly, essentially, used the government, directly used the government to profiteer as a private citizen, building his own wealth. And even worse than that, not even trying to hide it. How does he get away with it? He says it. I'm doing it. I'm going to continue to do it. Catch me if you can. And even if you do, I'm going to still continue to do it. Damn the Constitution or anything else. How does he get away with it, Wilmer? That's the $64 question.
And to anybody listening that might say, well, okay, but Mar-a-Lago raised its entry fee from $100,000 to his membership fee to $200,000 the day Donald Trump was elected. And the way that he gets away with it, you've got a Republican Party that is spineless. You have to a great degree an American media that is complicit, and you've got a Democratic Party that can't seem to find a message. I would say that's how he gets away with it.
Well, I got to say, is there anything left after that?
Just me and you, bruh. And that's why you do your show, and that's why I do mine.
I got to tell you, it gets awful lonely out there. You know, if that's the case, let's walk through that. You got a GOP that's spineless, that essentially rubber stamps everything he's doing uncritically because it's vested interests, obviously. You got a Democratic Party that essentially hasn't quite.
Wait a minute. Don't go through that so quickly. You said a Democratic Party that rubber stamps what he does.
But Republican Party.
I'm sorry. A Republican Party that rubber stamps what he does. I think they're afraid of him. This goes back to, and as I say all the time, things don't happen in a vacuum. This goes back to the Tea Party before Donald Trump even threw his hat in the ring. This goes back to Tom Tancredo, former Congressman Tom Tancredo, the head of the Tea Party at the time, saying, you know, we want our country back. And you had armed members of the Tea Party bringing their weapons to events. You had members of the Tea Party spitting at Congressman John Lewis and calling him names less than favorable, and calling Barney Frank names, and so on and so forth, and Emanuel Cleaver as well, and Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham and other members of the Republican elite failing to call those people to task. And so I think this fear of that element of the party goes all the way back to the beginning of the Tea Party. And now, because they have allowed that element to run roughshod over them, you now have Donald Trump as president. We can go back to Sarah Palin and the fact that they allowed a Sarah Palin to assume the position of Republican nominee. And she, to me, is the one that brought the stupidity into the conversation. And Donald Trump just capitalized on the path that Sarah Palin forged.
Well, what you're saying, Wilmer, is basically the GOP was hijacked by the Tea Party. They became the Tea Party. That's why you don't need a Tea Party anymore. Why do you need them? We got the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
I think more intriguing, though, you know, that I got.
Okay.
And I can see that I got the progression. I think what's more intriguing is two other elements that you brought to the table. The Democratic Party, supposedly the opposition party, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
But even more intriguing to me, something that's near and dear to both you and I, something we have been intimately involved with the better part of our professional lives, namely the media. And I have to say this, Wilmer. I don't know how you're reading this in terms of the mainstream media. And by that, I'm talking about CNN. I throw them in there.
Right.
ABC, NBC, CBS. Not the print media, the electronic media. I'm only talking about them because both of us know the overwhelming majority of the American people get their news and information, quote unquote, not from the New York Times, not from the Washington Post. That's too complicated for most. They get it from the idiot box.
To be more specific, you're talking about MSNBC, as opposed to NBC, And you're talking about CNN and so forth, so on and so forth.
So when you look, and actually really we're talking about the networks.
Right.
Than anything.
Right.
But having said that, I'll throw them all in the mix, the electronic media, making a distinction. What has just amazed me to see this, and I started writing about this when I began noticing this about 2.5 years ago, not now, not last year, but even before that, with the rise of Trump, going back before he even declared in 2016 he was going to be a presidential candidate. Actually, as far back as 2012 with the whole Obama Berkeley thing, when he really kind of just rammed himself, you know, on the national political scene, how the mainstream media, much of that, and a lot of the cable media too, how they basically aided and abetted this guy. If he belched, if he sneezed, if he broke wind, if he did anything, it became part of the 24-hour news cycle, endlessly looped over and over and over again. I was just fascinated by this. And yeah, there was criticism, and there he is, you know, MSNBC, CNN, some of the commentators, you know, they take the big shots at him, but it doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is he's still there. Whether you criticize him or not, he's literally being shoved down our throat every step of the way. You know, Wilmer, I'm just incredulous watching this scene and how this has unfolded.
And Les Moonves, the CEO and president of CBS, made it very clear during the 2016 campaign in saying that Donald Trump is good for ratings, which means Donald Trump is good for ad revenue dollars. We're making money hand over fist off of this guy, and we're going to keep doing it until this gravy train ends.
Yeah. Well, and they're not going to end it. They're going to keep it going. So here's the deal on this, Wilmer. As we approach November, the midterm elections, and of course, beyond that, 2020, I mean, the guy is already gearing up for, you know, his reelection bid. I'm wondering if this doesn't change side by side with the boom, quote unquote, booming economy. I said, quote unquote, it's the appearance of that. Given the fact that the media is in his hip pocket, they pretty much are. It's a Trump media and a semblance of a humming economy. I have to tell you, Wilmer, I'm not totally optimistic about the future, barring a miracle. And that brings me now to the Democratic Party, the third element that you brought into the mix. Are they going to be, you've got a divided party, and I think we talked about that last week.
Yes.
You got the centrists, and you got the Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Wing, and you know, they're infighting back and forth. Can they, in fact, at some point between now and the start of the presidential silly season, when it really kicks into high gear, can they find a unifying message? You mentioned that before, the message. Is that possible? To counter some of the emulence, the corruption, the lies, the overwhelming dominance in the mainstream media, the money train that's there? Can they construct a message in unity and bring it together as a united party to put some candidates that can win in the right states and find somebody who's credible that can challenge this guy one-on-one at the presidential level? Can they do that?
And I think the answer, as I sit here right now, on the 27th of July, I think the answer is no. And the primary reason my answer is no is because I think the Democrats, to a great degree, the Democratic elite and establishment are still trying to play, or they think they can still play, to a number of people that are in the Trump base. And they fail to understand that the lines of demarcation are very clear, very stark, and very wide, and that you're not going to sway that white male Trump voter or the 57% of white women who voted for Trump. And they need to understand that the progressive discussion in this country, the healthcare discussion, the college discussion, those are the things that the education discussion, those are the things that are going to win, but they don't want to go there because they're afraid of being labeled the party of the people of color. Your thoughts as we have to wrap this up to my point.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I'm going to be a little bit more optimistic only because I have to for my sanity.
Got it. You got about 45 seconds.
I'm going to hope that they can pull all the elements together, a lot of moving parts there, that unity, that cohesion, and also find and craft that message and reach out and broaden out their base. I hope they can do that.
You know what, Earl? I'm sorry, but to your point, I am optimistic as well. I need to change my no to a I think they can, but unfortunately, by the time they figure it out, it's going to be too late. How about that as a compromise?
How about this, William, on a qualified yes.
Okay. Hey, man, I really appreciate it, Earl. Thank you very much. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. And to those on Facebook, thank you again for listening. Thank you for subscribing and watching. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.